You're listening to the Weekly Sermon Podcast from Trinity Church Denver. To find out more about Trinity, visit our website, trinitychurchdenver.org.
There is running the gamut through Romans, and actually, I just want to say this before we get going on Romans. We had presbytery this week, which means I had presbytery this week. And so for those of you who have no idea what that means, and that's like a foreign language to you, I'm going to take 3 seconds to describe for you the larger structure of which our church is a part. We believe that God, in fact, we just confessed together that we're part of one holy Catholic church. In other words, we believe that our church doesn't stand alone in isolation, but actually we belong to and have obligations to other churches, that we belong to a part of a larger body of churches. And so our participation in that takes a couple of different forms. And so our church is a part of what's called the Knox Presbytery, of the CREC. And the Knox Presbytery meets twice a year. And the way that the authority structure in our denomination works is most things should be decided and are ruled over by each individual church's session or their elders. But then there are a handful of things. So if you think of the elders, your particular session, our particular body of elders is like the local government. And so most things are decided at that level. And then we're a part of the presbytery. The presbytery is like the state government, only it's a lot of states. We're actually the furthest south and furthest east of all the churches in our presbytery. And so we always travel to the Great Northwest twice a year to meet. And there's a handful of things that are decided at the presbytery level, a handful of things in which the presbytery gives guidance to the individual churches in the presbytery. And so I went this past week for 3 days up to Idaho, and I met with a bunch of pastors pastoring in everywhere from this tiny little town in Canada all the way down to us. And we talked about what's happening in our world. We talked about wisdom for the churches. We approved and kind of examined and approved a pastor for a church in Missoula, Montana that for 13 years, get this, for 13 years they've been gathering for worship without a pastor, a ministering elder, a lead pastor to preach them, to lead them, to teach them. And we got to examine, interview, pray over, lay hands on a pastor that will be taking over that church after 13 years. Like, that's awesome that we get to be a part of things like that. And then once every 3 years, those state governments get together, those presbyteries get together in what's called council. And so council actually is going to be meeting this fall. It's the third year. And we're going to be gathering in Louisiana with a bunch of churches from all over the country, all over the world, to decide a handful of things and talk about a handful of things that we see as applicable to all of the churches that we would want to address. And so this past week, I got to go and sit and pray and hear updates from all these different churches that we're connected to, that we're helping to pray for and serve all over the Northwest United States and into Canada. And so just wanted you to know that. That's what we did. And so we're a part of that body. And God is at work doing pretty marvelous things in really strange and wonderful ways in churches that we're connected to formally. It's an encouragement to know. Like, I just would say to you, without getting into details, because I still want to preach a sermon, God is not like gone away. He's not like hiding during this time. He is active and at work. And he's raising up churches, faithful churches that will serve him and love him and bear witness to the reign of Jesus and the resurrection of Jesus, that are faithfully serving and loving the places that they've been planted in, whether it's a small town or larger cities. And we're a part of that. And I just that even serves a bit of a segue for us into how we're going to launch into Romans chapter 11. We're going to spend the next 3 weeks in Romans chapter 11. And as we do so, kind of hanging over all of Romans 9 through 11, but particularly as we think about Romans chapter 11, is one of the ideas that percolated to the top in Romans chapter 8. Now, it's been a while since we've looked at Romans chapter 8. So I want to remind you of one of the themes that lay at the heart of Romans 8, that's really Paul's trying to work that theme out for us in a really tangible way as we get to chapter 11. And that theme is that the suffering, the struggle, the pain that you experience in your own life and we bear witness to in the world is not that God is working despite those things, But God is working precisely through and in and through those things. In other words, when you encounter trouble, or what Paul says calls in Romans 8, groaning, all kinds of trouble. In Romans 8, it runs the gamut from creational pain, like pandemics, to sin and persecution and injustice. So the full gamut of that, and everything in between. That when you experience that, or when you see that, what Paul calls the people of God to witness, to see, to believe, to hold fast to, it is not that God is at work somewhere else, and that in the end it'll all work out. No, his claim in Romans 8 is quite more severe than that. It is that God is at work in the midst of, through all of that sin, all of that pain, all of those difficulties. That God is doing something with it. It's a means to his end of seeing all of this world filled with resurrection life and glory and goodness and beauty. These things aren't happening off on the side, and God's trying to do something over here. Another theme that's become popular within evangelical circles is that God is somehow at war in this world. And then when you see suffering and difficulty, you're seeing what God is at war with in this world. That's not what Paul says in Romans 8. He says that all of that pain, all of that suffering, all of that persecution, all of those things happening in this world are birth pains. It is the world, it is creation, it is history giving birth to something. Namely, giving birth to the people of God. So what that means is that the heart of Romans is this holding up of what God has done in Jesus, the way that he saves us, the way that he redeems us and rescues us from the wrath of God. He wants all of that to come to rest on this bedrock faith, and that the people of God would be unshakable in the face of suffering and pain. Not because we know, hey, it'll all work out in the end, but because we know the sovereign God of the universe is at work precisely in the midst of all of that pain and difficulty to give birth to something in the world that is beautiful and good and redemptive, and something at which he says we will look at all of the pain and all of the suffering and all of the difficulty of this age, and we will say it was like nothing compared to the glory that's to be given to us. Now, what Paul is about to do for us through the course of Romans chapter 11 is play that out along one particular historical timeline that deals with the Jews and the Gentiles and their relationship, and how God is using the relationship historically between the Jews and the Gentiles and what he's done in Jesus to bring about something at the end of which Paul kind of launches into verses 34 through 36, simply a hymn of worship. He's going to unfold a complicated history. There are actually few places in the whole Bible more debated than these verses throughout the history of interpretation. But he's going to unfold this complicated argument for how we're to understand what God is doing in history between the Jews and the Gentiles, such that at the end of it, Paul is going to kind of do the whole choral thing and have everyone stand up and just begin singing. So that's where we're headed. But underlying it is this theology of history, this theology of suffering and pain and sin and difficulty that sees at the root of all of it the sovereign work of God for the good of his people. And so that's the theme that we're going to come back to all three of these weeks, again and again and again. Because at the end of the day, it becomes a framework through which my prayer is that we, all of us individually, as families and as a church, it becomes the lens by which and through which we interpret everything happening around us in the world. It's my experience that this theology is a buoy, it's an anchor. When life is insane and painful and difficult and you don't know what on earth you're doing, to have the anchor of, I don't know exactly what's happening, but I do know this, that God himself is at work in it and through it. And that is an anchor that is unmovable if it's fixed in Scripture. So we're going to come back to that again and again and again. And so, Romans 11. How is Paul going to get us there? Paul comes back to the question that he's been driving at since chapter 9, which is, well, what are we to make of the fact that on the whole, for the most part, the Jewish people, those who had interpreted, had received the law of God, had carried for all of humanity the promises of God, and the ones who had been shown how to worship God, had seen more clearly than anyone else on earth what God was like, the nature of his holiness, knew the story of how he made the world. This people who knew and received these promises, this law, this wisdom, this worship, had received all these things, for the most part, had rejected all of the promises of God because they had rejected Jesus. What are we to do with that? That poses a massive problem, by the way. That here is a nation, historically, that has received more grace, more of God's gifts, more of God's kindnesses, more of God's revelation, more of God's words than any other people on earth. And for the most part, they looked at Jesus and said, no, thank you. We're not interested. That's a problem, right? It's a massive problem. And so Paul in Romans 9 begins answering that question by saying that flesh, whether it's genetics, like the family that you're born in or the nation that you're born in, and flesh as good works, can make no claims on God. In other words, nobody can stand before God and say, look at the family I'm a part of. You owe me. No one can stand before God and say, look at the ethnicity that I carry here. You owe me something. No one can stand before God and say, look at all of my good works. You owe me something. Romans 9, Paul says, no, that the salvation of God, the mercy of God, the grace of God is utterly dependent upon God's sovereign mercy, his will, not ours. So no one has anything that they can take and use as a leverage point on God. Remember, it drove us again to look at where he's headed in Romans 11. Paul describes salvation in such a way that all that we're left to say is that all things are from him and through him and to him. He didn't meet me halfway. He didn't meet me 2/3 of the way. He didn't meet me 95% of the way. He saved me. He rescued me. And anyone who stands before God stands because he made them stand. That was Romans 9. Romans 10, he draws a conclusion, Paul does, that therefore God has sent people into the world to declare the good news that God reigns in Jesus. And that anyone from Jew or Gentile can be made a part of this covenant people by believing and confessing that Jesus is Lord, that he was raised from the dead. And now at the beginning of chapter 11, Paul wants to bring us back to that original question about the Jews. And so he asks this question, has God rejected his people? In other words, has the judgment of God fell in such a way on all Israelites, all Jewish people, such that none of them can be saved? Has he rejected them? In other words, if you're a Jew here this morning, the question Paul wants to ask, wants to address, is essentially, is it possible for you to be a part of the covenant people of God and receive all of those covenant promises that have been handed down for generations? Or, in his judgment, has he just rejected all Jewish people altogether? That's the question. And Paul's answer to that is no. He hasn't rejected his people, to clarify the answer there. His answer is, The question is, has God rejected, utterly rejected, all of the Jewish people? And Paul's answer is no, he hasn't utterly rejected all of the Jewish people. And his first example, his first reason, kind of example for how God hasn't rejected all the Jewish people is he looks at, points at himself, says, I'm a Jew, and I believe in Jesus. I've received these promises. And then he goes on to illustrate for us in these first six verses the fact that this is, in the darkest moments of all of Israel's history, what God has done again and again and again. That is that he has taken a remnant of Jews, a remnant of people who inherited the covenant promises of God, and he's kept them, and he's protected them, and he's watched over them, and he's kept them safe and faithful. Kept them from apostasy, kept them from chasing after idols, kept them from worshiping false gods, kept their worship from becoming corrupted by the idolatries that surrounded them. I mean, he's kept them in the faith as a remnant. And he uses Elijah as a prime example of that. In the days of Elijah, it was a wicked time in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. They chased after false gods, intermingling with the worship of Yahweh, the worship of Baal, sacrificing children, murdering babies. And in the midst of all of it, Elijah claims that he's the only one. What does God tell him? No, I've kept for myself a remnant. People who have not bowed the knee to false gods. They belong to me. And so Paul's answer, his first answer to what's happening with Israel is to bring home for us a principle that kind of runs through the whole gamut of scripture, is that there are always two Israels. There's always two covenant peoples of God. And here's what I mean by that. There's the larger Israel, or in our day, the larger church. All who claim the promises of God, all who attribute that their religious orientation to Jesus and Christianity, all who are by name Christians. And there is within that larger group, both in Israel and now within the church, a group, a remnant, a people who are kept faithful, a people who continue to believe and hold fast to the teachings, the law, the promise, and put all of their hope in Jesus. What Paul holds out is that what God has always been up to is there's always been within this group, as he says, take you back to Romans chapter 2. He talks about those who are circumcised in the flesh versus those who are circumcised in the heart. There's always been the people who outwardly perform like or presume to be like Christians, but who aren't. And then right alongside them is a people who have hearts that are circumcised, who have hearts that truly love and delight in God. What Paul says is he points to Israel at his time, and he says, if you look at Israel, even now, there are Jews who believe in Jesus. There are Jews who've received the promises of God in Jesus and put all their hope and trust in him. They worship him, they love him, they delight in him, and they're obeying God through Jesus. And there's Jews that have rejected the promises of God. They've rejected the rule of his Messiah. They've rejected the fulfillment of all of their scriptures in Jesus. And this is always case. I'm going to kind of tip my hat to some places we're going to go next week. One of the questions that arises as you read Romans chapter 11 that we have to deal with is, what's the relationship between the Jewish people or Israel and us, the church? And there's historically been a couple of different ways to go at this question. And one is to say that they are two different covenants and two different people. So you have Israel, and Israel is only ever Israel or ethnic Jews. And then you have the church, which is this new covenant, this new group of people who has no formal connection to the Jewish people outside of Jesus. I think that's wrong. I'm not going to go into the full explanation. We'll get into more of it next week. But the reason why I think that's wrong is because the primary illustration that Paul is going to use for us next week, starting in verse 11, is that there's one tree. And that those who belong to Jesus have been grafted into that one tree. He doesn't say there's two trees. Like there's this tree that's having some trouble, and so God now has planted a new tree. He says there's one tree, and that God is cutting some branches off of that one tree, and he's grafting into it us, namely Gentiles, into that one original tree. In other words, there's one covenant people of God. And so the relationship I would say that's here is that as God has worked throughout history, he hasn't moved now to something new with the church as much as he's now grafted a people from all the nations of the earth, from every ethnic tribe under the sun, and he's grafted us into this tree that was originally planted with Abraham. Okay? We'll come back to that next week some more, as Paul is going to kind of explain how this one tree is kind of working itself out in history. But the main idea that I want us to get at or to see is that there are Christians who aren't Christians. There are Jews who aren't Jews. There are those in this city, and perhaps even in this room, who claim the name of Jesus, who showed up here this morning, and you don't belong to Jesus. And Paul's explanation for what's happening in his time, as he looks around and sees vast unbelief among those who should believe, is to explain that there is always an Israel that is not Israel. There's always a church that isn't the church. There's always a people who claim to belong to God, but who don't. Which drives us to a really somber question this morning. How do you know? Right? Look at this for a second. Verse 7, Israel failed to obtain what it was seeking. This unbelieving Israel failed to obtain what it's seeking. What was it seeking? It was seeking salvation, it was seeking righteousness, it was seeking to receive all the promises of God. According to Romans 4, to inherit the whole earth. So here's the question I want to pose for us this morning. Don't you want to obtain what you're seeking? Do you want salvation? Do you want the promises of God? Do you want eternal life with him forever and ever and ever? Do you want to know the glories of his majesty and his grace and his beauty? Do you want to know his perfect righteousness and peace forever and ever and ever? Do you want that? Well, this question matters to you. Oh, you don't want to be like unbelieving Israel. You don't want to be a Christian in name only. You do not want to be a person sitting in this room playing at Christianity. Old pastor friend of mine used to say, it's the worst hobby in the world. Oh, don't let Christianity be a hobby for you. Don't let love for Jesus be a hobby for you. Don't let the law of God be a hobby for you. Do you know how many pastors I have met for whom the law of God is a game, a puzzle that they play at? That the words of God are mere playthings to be toyed with, to be turned, to be twisted, such that they become attractive to the right kinds of people, so that they sound like they're on the right side of history, so that they sound like they're pursuing the right ends or the right aims, so that they can be approved of by a watching, unbelieving world. Oh, this is grave and serious and real. Unbelief. Unbelief will destroy you. Do not play at Christianity. And so, the question arises, how do you know? Paul's going to quote three Old Testament texts in the next couple of verses, verses 8, 9, and 10. He's going to quote these Old Testament verses as a way of describing for his listeners the nature of those who play at being Israel or play at being the church. He's going to describe the kind of people who would ostensibly seek after righteousness or seek after salvation or seek after the promises of God, but in truth are abandoning those promises, are not finding salvation, and are not receiving the salvation that God has given us in Jesus. So he's going to answer the question, how do you know, by pointing at these Old Testament texts which describe the nature of the Israel which is not Israel, or, for our sake, is going to describe for us the nature of the church which is not the church. Okay? Now what's fascinating here is he quotes from the law, Deuteronomy 29, quotes from the prophets, Isaiah 29, and he quotes from the writings, Psalm 69. Those are the three components that make up the Old Testament canon, the law, the prophets, and the writings. So Paul goes back and he finds three texts from three different places that encompass the whole of the Old Testament, and essentially by doing so, before we actually even get to the details, says this has always been God's warning. He's always said it's going to work this way. This isn't a surprise. He's deeply concerned here in Romans 11 to make sure that we know God's not standing in heaven surprised by this. It's what he promised. It's what he's planned. It is yet another means by which he's accomplishing his purposes for the whole earth. So let's look at the three specifics. First, he quotes Deuteronomy chapter 29. And he talks about the judgment that will come upon the people of Israel if they abandon the law of God, or they begin to distort the law of God, or they refuse to obey and live under the law of God. In Deuteronomy 29, it's a famous text. He says, I set before you life and death, blessings and a curse. That he was setting before Israel, this is how you're to live before me. This is how you're to worship me. This is how you're to pursue me. This is how you're to know who I am and how you're to live out and worship in the midst of the world. And here's how you're to relate to your neighbor. Here's how you're to love me, and here's how you're to love your neighbor. These are specific instructions about how you're to love, and specifically how you're to pursue God and love God, and how you're to pursue loving your neighbor. And in setting these before you, I'm setting before you blessings and a curse. If you obey these laws, if you come under these laws, if you live under my rule, well, you'll inherit all the blessings of the covenant. You'll receive all the promises that I have to give. But if you abandon them, if you twist them, if you distort them, if you begin to use them in ways that do not honor me and do not pursue the good of your neighbor, you'll inherit all the curses of this covenant. And the curses are marked by a spirit of stupor, blindness, the inability to see and understand the world as it is. So how do you make sure, pursue being a people who aren't blind, aren't playing at Christianity? You need to understand the point that to reject the law of God, to reject the instructions of God, to take what God has commanded and to twist it, to distort it, is blinding. It's fatal. And it's happening all over the place. All over our culture is this refusal to submit to and to love and to receive on the instructions that God has given his people in his law. We take the words and we take words like justice, we take words like righteousness, we take them and we twist them, or we ignore them altogether. Or for some of us, just like the Pharisees, we take the law of God, and rather than seeing it as this is how, what should motivate your obedience to the law, what should drive your obedience to the law is I want to love God and I want to love my neighbor. Instead, the law becomes a means of self-righteousness, it becomes a means of beating other people down, becomes a means of building yourself up and isolating yourself from all the people around you. No, rather than receiving from God his grace and his mercy, and out of gratitude for his grace and his mercy, we seek to obey and live under his rule by obeying his law in all areas of life. Instead, the law becomes a means of establishing my own ego. This is blinding. Oh, please know this. We live in a secular age. An age in which belief in God is okay if you want to, and unbelief is considered reasonable. And in an age like that, we call what is unjust, just. We call what is good, evil. We call what is evil, good. And it plays itself out again and again and again, whether we're talking about gender or sexual morality or race relations or whatever it is being taken up by the culture around us, and they are subverting the very words, the very instructions of God. And so you have a church that is not the church. Second, Isaiah 29. Isaiah 29, he talks about the God in his judgment. Again, it's actually quoting Deuteronomy 29. It says he's going to come and give them a spirit of stupor. I mean, he goes beyond it, though, and says, I'm going to give them eyes that will not see and ears that cannot hear. And it's going to come down all the way to this very day. And why is he going to give them that? Because they have mouths that honor God, but hearts that do not fear him. In fact, the fear of God is taught as a commandment of men. Isaiah says, right after this passage. He goes on to say, specifically, I think it's verse 15, no. I think it's verse 15 in Isaiah 29. That we turn things upside down. The potter becoming the clay, and the clay becoming the potter. I think Paul actually references this text to remind us back of Romans chapter 9, that God is the sovereign one. But you see, what happens in a blinding Christianity, in a fake Christianity, in a church that is not the church, is that we reverse roles. God becomes the clay and we become the potter. I begin to make God into whatever image I want him to be, rather than submitting to the God who is there. I begin to reform God into an image that I like, rather than trusting and worshiping God as he's revealed himself to be. I presume to be God, even God over history. I'm dictating to God what he should do and how he should rule and how history should go. In other words, at the heart of this kind of Christianity is an absolute distortion of the nature and the character of God. This is a Christianity that is not Christian. This is what the church does when it's no longer the church. This is what playing at Christianity looks like. You remake God in your own image, presuming to take the role of potter and making God into clay. This is blindness. It's a drunken stupor. You will not understand the world or how to live in it if you remake God in your own image. Last, Psalm 69. Psalm 69 is the psalm, one of the psalms that Jesus quotes from the cross. And Psalm 69 is the description of God's servant being persecuted, and destroyed, and killed. And in it, God, Jesus, pronounces a curse upon those who are attacking him. And he says, let their table become a snare and a trap, a stumbling block and a retribution for them. Let their eyes be darkened so that they cannot see and bend their backs forever. At the heart of a Christianity that plays at Christianity is a refusal to bow the knee to Jesus. A refusal to see him as Lord and King and Savior. A refusal to see his cross as necessary, as beautiful, as good, that his atonement for your sins is the only way of salvation. It's to look at Jesus and to distort him, to twist him, to make him some sort of something that he's not. And it's a refusal to acknowledge that he is Lord of the nations. That he is King over all. This is a Christianity that plays at Christianity, a church that is not the church, a Christian who is not a Christian. And we do this in myriads of ways, right? Like we do this sometimes just ostensibly, just out in the open, how we teach about Jesus, but oftentimes it happens in far more subtle ways in the church. Preachers who won't preach the full counsel of God. Preachers who won't hold out a full image and picture of Jesus as Lord and King. Preachers who won't call men and women and governors and mayors and presidents to bow the knee and serve and worship Jesus. It takes the form of people liking particularly Americanized Jesus. A Jesus who takes up their particular political causes. A Jesus who adjusts his definitions of what is just and right and true to fit secular social ideas about what those things are true. Refuses to deal with Jesus on his own terms. It refuses to bend the knee to Jesus in his own terms. It refuses to acknowledge the sufficiency of the cross and the glory of the resurrection. These are not small things. Paul quotes Psalm 69 because they are deadly. They are playing at Christianity. It's a Christian in name only, but it is not a Christianity that saves, that redeems, that restores, that renews. It is blindness and a drunken stupor. There will always be two churches until the last day, two Israels, two covenant peoples. Oh, that you would not be blind and not be drunk, but that you would see and worship Jesus. That the proclamation that you should fear God would not come as a commandment from the outside, but arising from within, you would tremble before him and worship. When you hear his law, you wouldn't ignore it. You wouldn't marginalize it. You wouldn't seek ways to say, well, I don't really have to do that or listen to that. No, you'd find ways to come under it, to seek to understand the world and to see wisdom in all the things that God has commanded. Oh, that you would see. And in closing, I want to bring us back to where we were 2 weeks ago on Easter. I love the story of the Emmaus Road. Jesus walking with two disciples and he's talking to them. He's doing a Bible study with them. He's leading them this whole thing and they have no clue who he is. The text literally says their eyes were kept from seeing who he was. Very similar language to the language used in Isaiah 29. In fact, a number of scholars have said that Luke actually has Isaiah 29 in mind. But by the end of that story, they see. By the end of that story, they're racing back to Jerusalem to announce who Jesus is, that he's been raised from the dead. By the end of that story, they're going to instruct the disciples themselves on what God has accomplished in Jesus. Where did Jesus open their eyes? At a table with bread and wine. I mean, don't you love the way God tells stories? Like, stop for a second. Think about that. He leads them in a Bible study. The end of it, they don't understand anything. But Jesus sits with them and he takes bread and he tears it. He feeds them. And they see.